Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and every now and then I get to do what I want or talk about what I want. And the one thing I would like to do in preparing for Christmas is to talk to Jimmy Akin about the Nativity. And I've got a whole bunch of questions to ask Jimmy, so we're going to just make it a conversation this hour as we close out the week. So I hope it's a conversation that you will enjoy. We're going to let assistant producer Marie take a break for the hour. We won't be taking calls. We're just going to be having a discussion, me and Jimmy, about the Nativity of Jesus. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. Thanks for coming back and talking about baby Jesus with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And even though it's just a conversation, that doesn't mean you won't be saying the phone number.
Did I say it already? I don't know if I even did.
No,
but I will. You're right. At some point, I will say it. You're right.
It's habit.
All right. Well, if we could just start by talking about the period of history that we're in, in which the Lord is born into. What's going on in the world at that time? What's going on in Israel at that time?
Okay. So people will be familiar with the history of Israel. The Israelites come into the Promised Land a little more than 1,000 years before the time of Christ, either in the 1400s or the 1200s BC. King David lives around the year 1000 BC. And Israel, fairly quickly after David, it's just after Solomon, David's son, the kingdom breaks in two. And you have the northern tribes that secede from the southern tribes, and the northerners form the kingdom of Israel, and the south is the kingdom of Judah. And then the Assyrians end up conquering the 10 northern tribes and take many of them away to live over in Iraq and Iran, and that's where the 10 lost tribes are. Mm-hmm. And then the southern kingdom continues for a while, but then it gets conquered by Babylon. And Babylon gets conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire, and then they get conquered by the Greeks with Alexander the Great. And that's what spreads the Greek language all over this part of the world, because gave us the language of the New Testament. Greek had become the main international language, and so that's why people all over the place spoke it, and that's why the New Testament is written in Greek. In fact, even once Rome takes charge, they largely speak Greek in Rome, not just Latin. If you were educated in Rome, you spoke both Greek and Latin. And how Rome gets control is kind of interesting. Now, after Alexander the Great died, his kingdom, his empire, fell apart. And when he died, and he died under some rather mysterious circumstances, we're not exactly sure what killed him. It may have been a drinking bout. It may have been a disease. But when he was dying, he allegedly was asked, to whom should the kingdom go? Because he was so young, he was just in his 30s, he didn't have an appointed successor. And he had a son, but his son was retarded and was not really fit to govern. So they didn't know who his successor was going to be. And he allegedly said, the kingdom goes to the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a
very
signal for conflict among his generals. And he had four main generals that that after his death decided not to fight each other. Rather than have a big war for control of the empire, they were at Babylon at the time in Iraq, and they said, let's just divide up the kingdom into four pieces. And that was what was known as the settlement of Babylon. So they set up four dynasties in different areas of Alexander's empire, but their successors got into conflict with each other. So even though they didn't have a big immediate war, there were wars. And Israel happened to be in a border zone between two of the successor empires. One is the Ptolemaic Empire. The Ptolemies were the Greek pharaohs of Egypt. After Alexander, took over Egypt, it was Greeks in charge. And then up in Syria, there was another dynasty called the Seleucids. And the Seleucids and the Ptolemies would war with each other, and Israel was caught in the middle. And eventually, Israel was having, it had some limited autonomy after the after they came back from the Babylonian exile, but it it was kind of fragile, and you had a succession dispute in Israel, and the Seleucids got involved and ended up taking over. And that's what gave us the holiday of Hanukkah.
Oh yeah,
that's right. Being celebrated right now, because the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple at Jerusalem, and so when the Maccabees revolted and reclaimed autonomy, they rededicated the temple, and that's what Hanukkah is. It's the feast of rededication, and Jesus himself celebrated Hanukkah. It's mentioned in John chapter 10 that he was in Jerusalem for the celebration of the feast of dedication, and that's what that is. That's Hanukkah. So they the Maccabees then led to a dynasty called the Hasmoneans, and they ruled Israel for a while into the first century BC, but then they had a succession dispute. There were a couple of rival brothers who both wanted to be king of Israel or of Judah, and so they did what their ancestors had. They decided to appeal to a foreign power because Rome was now the rising foreign power, and they appealed to the Roman general Pompey the Great about 63 BC, and his solution was take over Israel, or take over the Holy Land. And he came into Jerusalem, and he even entered the temple and demanded to see the Holy of Holies. He thought there was going to be like a big idol or a great treasure or something in the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant had been. And he was surprised that, no, it's empty. And of course, the Jews were horrified by a Gentile, because only the high priest is supposed to go in there only once a year. And here's this uncircumcised Roman pagan general going in there. So, but they couldn't stop him. And the Romans had a system where they tended not, in many cases, to rule directly. They would have local client kings. And the guy that ended up getting picked for that was Herod the Great. And so he was a kind of wheeler dealer, conniver. His father had been a high official. He was only really kind of half Jewish. He was an Idumean, which meant he was Jewish by faith, but not by ethnicity, because the Maccabees had forcibly converted the Idumeans to Judaism. And so that's how Herod ends up getting on the throne. So this Roman rule was actually quite recent. And there was still a lot of memory of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, in other words, and all that they had done to promote Jewish independence.
Right.
And there was this, in fact, there's a study that's done in different fields of what names, you know, what baby names are popular. And if you look at the baby names for that were popular in first century Judaism, they're all like members of the Maccabee family. That's why we have John and Johns and Judases and things like that, and James's all over in the New Testament. Those are Maccabean names. And so they're really idolizing the Maccabees, and they're hoping there's going to be there's this prophecy that the Messiah is coming. And even neighboring peoples had prophecies of a great king arising in this area. And so everybody in Israel is all ginned up about the idea that we're going to have a repeat of the Maccabees. We're going to have a Messiah born who's going to kick out these Romans and restore independence to us and restore the kingdom to Israel.
Also, all of that is the setting into which he's born then.
Right.
So it's almost like a kind of globalism, really. I mean, you know, it's not the whole globe, but it's very multicultural. The Greeks had tried to put it all
cosmopolitan.
Cosmopolitan, there you go. A very cosmopolitan setting. Right there at a crossroads of Asia and Africa and Europe.
Yes. Yeah. And it if you want to evangelize the world, starting from a juncture like that is a logical place to start. So there may be a reason God put the Holy Land right there.
We have to take a quick break. Jimmy Akins here with us, and I'm going to ask him whatever I want about the Nativity because it's just fun to get to ask Jimmy and pick his brain about all the things that we know about that time, the things that we don't know, the things we might speculate about. So we'll have a little bit of fun talking about the Nativity this hour. We have a free ebook that we're still giving out, Day by Day, Advent Apologetics. Lots of great answers to questions that will be, probably if the family gets together, people will be asking questions about the faith or things will come up and you might want to have some solid answers. You can get them in Day by Day Advent Apologetics. It's the free ebook available right now at shop.catholic.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Greetings, I'm Jerry Usher, co-host of Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, heard at noon and midnight Eastern here on EWTN Radio. This Advent, slow down, quiet your heart. Allow the Holy Spirit to reveal more deeply to you the true meaning of the Christmas season we'll be preparing for. The birth of Jesus on Christmas morning is an occasion of great joy. Remember, the better we prepare during Advent, the more joyful will be our Christmas. May God bless you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. 1 week now until Christmas. Next Friday is Christmas Day, and so we're trying to help you get into the spirit of Christmas Day and be prepared, kind of have your heart and soul prepared for welcoming the Lord. And so we're talking about the Nativity of Jesus. I almost gave out the phone number there, Jimmy. Almost did it.
And you resisted.
One save. I did. I resisted. If I could, Jimmy, I'm going to ask you about the sources for what we know about the Nativity. But first, I want to ask you about the census, because it was this a common thing in the ancient world? Is the census? It's the census and pay the tax. Is that the purpose of the census, or does the census have some other purpose?
The truthful answer is we don't know exactly what this was. What Luke says is that the decree went out from Caesar Augustus that the whole world should be enrolled. And the question is, enrolled how and in what?
Yeah.
Now, a very common theory is that it was a tax census. And so you would, count heads and charge everybody a certain amount of money, maybe based on the amount of land that they owned. And that's a possibility. The Romans did have, taxes. Every government has taxes,
right?
And so that's one of the, they say two things are certain: death and taxes. Well, as soon as money was invented, and really even before money was invented, there had been taxes.
Yeah.
In the old days, they'd take a share of your produce if you weren't using money. So the Romans definitely had taxes, and they periodically did tax censuses. There's some question about which one this is, though.
Okay.
We don't. Now, part of the difficulty is you need to identify in what year is Jesus born in order to say, well, was there a worldwide tax census at this time? And so that's one issue that complicates this. Another is the fact that we don't necessarily have complete records of everything the Romans did.
Yeah.
Because a lot has been lost. We know they had certain tax censuses, some of which were local. But it's been a little difficult to identify a specific one that Luke would have been talking about. And so there are other proposals, too. One of the things that we know about Augustus is that at a certain point in the year 3/2 BC, there was an event where the whole people of Rome, all the Roman Empire, swore allegiance to him as the father of the country.
Oh, okay.
And Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, records that that 6,000 Pharisees refused to say the oath, but everybody else, even in Israel, did. And so a proposal that some contemporary scholars have been exploring is maybe that's what this was.
Oh.
Because if you think Jesus was born in the year 3 or 2 BC, it could have been this this oath of allegiance to Augustus as the father of the nation. And that might be it. On the other hand, it might be it might have been a tax census. And one thing that people have puzzled over is the fact that Luke says this was when Quirinius was governing Syria. Quirinius was a Roman official who was set out as a governor, and one of his assignments was to govern Syria. And it's hard to see how that squares up with what Luke says, because we know about Quirinius being an official governor of Syria later than this.
Oh,
like
okay.
in the first decade after the birth of Christ. And so some scholars have said, well, how does this all match up? One proposal is that it's sometimes translated, this was the first census under mm-hmm. Quirinius. So there might have been a later one that we know about, and we just don't know about this. But actually, the Greek can also be translated before the census with Quirinius. And so it could be that Luke is clarifying, no, don't think about the famous census under Quirinius. It's not that one. It's before.
I see. Oh, okay.
And okay. So we're not entirely sure what this event was, but there are a number of possibilities. So if you hear a skeptic saying, oh, Luke is just wrong, no, there are multiple resolutions to this. The question is, which is the right one? Sure. Obviously, Luke knew what he was talking about, or he wouldn't bother mentioning this, because he's clearly trying to refer to something his audience will know about.
Right.
It's just that at this distance, we don't have as much knowledge as his original audience did.
Okay, so you mentioned Luke there because the census is mentioned in Luke's gospel, and Luke is one of the sources we have for the Nativity. Can you just talk mm-hmm. in general about the sources that we have for understanding the birth of Jesus?
The two best sources are Matthew and Luke. Both Matthew and Luke have what are called infancy narratives that deal with the childhood of Jesus. It's Matthew chapters 1 and 2 and also Luke chapters 1 and 2. And those are our primary sources of information. We do have other sources of information. Paul mentions the birth of Jesus a little bit. I mean, we have statements elsewhere in the New Testament that he's born of a virgin. Or mm-hmm. born of woman and things like that. So we have slight references, but nowhere near as much detail as we get from Matthew and Luke. Also, outside of the New Testament, we have a variety of early Christian documents that also record traditions about the birth of Christ. The earliest one that I'm familiar with is a work called The Ascension of Isaiah, which appears to have been written about AD 67. And it records some significant traditions about the birth of Jesus that we can talk about. We also there's another work from the first century, from the end of the first century, called The Odes of Solomon, which has an ode or hymn about Mary. And so we have some traditions there. We also, in the second century, we have some traditions from St. Justin Martyr in the mid-second century. There's also a document known that we often mention on Catholic Answers Live, known as the Proto-Evangelium of James or the Infancy Gospel of James, that has traditions about the birth of Christ. And there are others as well. So it's not only Matthew and Luke, but Matthew and Luke are the two best sources.
So when you look at Matthew and Luke, however, then what are their sources? Do we have any hint about that? Because they tell different aspects. I'm just going to throw out an idea to you, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this. None of this material is in Mark. Luke and Matthew tell the same story, but they give different details about mm-hmm. it. You know, one with the magi and one with the shepherds. And so it would seem like they have different sources, but what do you make of it?
Well, all of this material about Jesus's infancy had to come from Jesus's family. now, because they were the only ones keeping track of it. So Joseph could be one of the tradition bearers or tradents, to use a fancy word for it. Mary could be one of the tradents. Jesus himself could be one of the tradents, and other family members could be too. But somehow this all has to come from Jesus's family. And we know who at least one of the tradents was. Now, it's quite possible that Jesus could have told the disciples about some of this stuff himself. I don't have any evidence for that, but it's possible. But he may well have. But we do really well know who one of the tradents in the family was, and that's Mary. Because in Luke twice... Now, I should mention, ancient authors had ways of telling you who their source of information was without using a footnote, which is what we do today. We use a footnote. Ancient authors had other ways of doing it. One of them is a literary technique called an inclusio. And an inclusio is where you mention a person at the beginning of a story and at the end of a story so that it includes that entire story. And this is a way that ancient authors would signal, this is my source. It's the guy who's present from the beginning to the end of it.
I see.
And we see that with Peter in the Gospel of Mark. Peter's there at the beginning and the end. He's the primary source for the information in Mark. Luke, in the infancy narrative, twice mentions Mary, and he mentions her, I mean, he mentions her more than that, but he mentions her twice in a very specific way. He says, Mary treasured these things in her heart.
Right.
And that's another way of saying Mary remembered this.
Yes.
And the fact that Luke is telling us Mary remembered this is Luke's way of saying Mary is the tradent. She's the source of this information. And that could mean that Luke talked to Mary personally and interviewed her, or it could mean that Luke talked to people and interviewed people who had talked to Mary.
Yeah.
But one way or another, Luke is telling us this information in the infancy narrative is coming from Mary.
I gotcha. All right. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're talking about the Nativity of the Lord with Jimmy. The date, I suppose, is one thing people always want to know about. What day was he born? Obviously, zero. I mean, so when was he born? I mean, I was taught, I have to say, I was taught quite explicitly when I was in college by Bible teachers, 6 BC.
Okay. And you will commonly hear 6 BC. The logic for that goes, well, we know from Matthew and Luke that he was born during the reign of Herod the Great. Herod died in 4 BC, it is said. And he seems to have been born up to 2 years before Herod died, because that's how old he was when the Magi show up. And so if you take 4 BC and you go back a couple of years, you get to 6 or 7 BC. And so that's a commonly accepted date. The problem is the evidence for that is not actually good. The evidence is that Herod died later than 4 BC, that Herod died actually in 1 BC. Josephus is our source of information about when Herod died, and he says he died between a certain type of eclipse and Passover, and that did occur in 4 BC, but they were way too close together for all the events that Josephus mentions.
Okay.
The better fit is in 1 BC.
Okay.
And if you say 1 BC, you back up a year or two, you get to 2 or 3 BC. And that's what the church fathers say. There's a consensus among the church fathers that it's 3 or 2 BC. And that's what Luke seems to indicate. In Luke 3, Luke says that John the Baptist began his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius came to the throne in AD 14. His 15th year would be AD 29. He also says that when Jesus begins his ministry just after John the Baptist, he was about 30 years old. So you take AD 29, subtract 30, you would think that would be 1 BC, but there's no year zero.
Yeah.
So it actually is 2 BC. And so Luke also points at 3 or 2 BC.
And the thing is that there were calculations made by Dennis the Short, right, making the
calendar. Dionysius Exiguus.
Yeah, and so he was not quite guessing, but he didn't have all the information we have now when he made the year 81 the year that it was. That had he,
1 BC, technically.
Yeah, 1 BC. Okay, so 1 BC the year that it was. He didn't have the educated guess, yeah.
And all of these are guesses, but the evidence is that Dennis the Short missed it by like a year or so.
Okay. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're talking about the nativity of the Lord. If you have questions, but no, we're not taking questions. We're just talking with Jimmy. I got a whole list of questions, and I'm going to keep moving through them. I want to ask about whether Jesus was really born on December 25th, and something about the we'll ask a couple questions about the genealogies of Jesus, which are not the same, and a whole bunch of other stuff when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
To many people, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the Church. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I'll give you the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Monday on More to Life, home for the holidays.
Holidays looking a bit different this year. We'll help you make them special.
That's Monday on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm getting to talk with Jimmy Akin about the nativity, and I've got so many questions. I thought, well, I'm just going to make this a conversation because, maybe you're doing some baking or taking care of things and maybe even traveling. I don't know. And it'd be nice to just hear from Jimmy about the nativity of the Lord. So that's what we are doing this hour. Let's go to December 25th then. We talked about the year he was born.
Okay.
Some people, no way he was born on December 25th. What are the chances? Is it 1 in 365? or is it better?
I think it's better than 1 in 365, but I also don't think it's certain.
Yeah, okay.
You will have, the Gospels really don't give us information about this. And actually, birthdays don't seem to have been commonly celebrated by ordinary people. This is something that is kind of surprising to people because in our culture, birthdays are very important. Every kid looks forward to his birthday. Parents know exactly when the kid's birthday is going to be, at least the mothers do.
Yeah.
And birthdays are just a huge thing for us. And so there can be a tendency on the part of a lot of modern people to think, oh, well, of course, Mary, they would celebrate Jesus' birthday, and Jesus and Mary would have known exactly when this was, and it's so important. Of course, they would have passed it on, and later Christians would have known about it. Well, if it was that important, it would be in Matthew or in Luke.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't that important that this tradition be passed on. Also, though, the evidence really is that ordinary people in this culture in this time tended to frown on birthdays. Birthdays were something that were celebrated by royalty.
Mm-hmm.
They would have these big, lavish parties, and they sometimes would get up to no good. I mean, there would be gluttony, there would be drunkenness, there could be sexual immorality. You could have your favorite prophet have his head brought in on a platter.
Oh, I forgot about that. Right, right.
Yeah. Birthdays were kind of frowned upon. There's only, if memory serves, there's two people in the Bible that have birthdays mentioned. One is Pharaoh, and one is the son of Herod the Great that cuts off John the Baptist's head. And if you look at the early church fathers, they are kind of down on birthdays. Now, there's nothing wrong with birthdays, but the way they looked at it, they would say, oh, well, this is not a good thing to celebrate. You have these wicked examples. And what's really important is your birthday into heaven, which is the day you die.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually, you'll find early church fathers saying, do not celebrate birthdays if you're a sincere Christian. Now, that was their opinion. That was their time. That's not for us. Birthdays are fine. But they just didn't emphasize them. And even today, in some places, people have no idea what their birthday was. I mean, there, in fact, a lot of times people in certain cultures, like among the Bedouins today in Israel, they won't know how old they are. They'll know approximately, yeah, I was born during the reign of this prime minister, but I don't know exactly what year it was.
Uh-huh.
And this has been kind of startling for anthropologists from the West to discover that. So we don't have certainty about what exact day Jesus was born. The only piece of evidence that is cited against Jesus being born December 25th from the Gospels is the fact that Luke records the shepherds were out in their fields on the night Jesus was born. And you'll have a lot of Western scholars who have said things like, well, it couldn't have been in December then because it's too cold to keep sheep outdoors.
Yeah.
And that's absolute nonsense. In fact, to this day, shepherds pasture their flocks in Israel, in Bethlehem, on December 25th. There's a famous letter from one biblical scholar to another back in the 1960s who was there in Shepherd's Field, and he was like, oh, guess what? The shepherds have their sheep out, and they even have the baby lambs with them. So this is not an argument Jesus being born December 25th. In fact, if you actually study up on winter sheep care, if you Google winter sheep care, you will find out sheep have wool.
And I already knew that.
and that keeps them warm in the cold weather. In fact, like other animals, they fleece up for the cold weather. And they evolved growing up outdoors in the winter. They didn't have barns, in 10,000 BC. Mm-hmm. That was the sheep weren't even domesticated then. And so they naturally live outdoors during the winter, and they're just fine. And in fact, they didn't have big heated sheep barns to put the sheep in the winter in first century Israel. So yeah, they were out there in the wintertime. In fact, sheep can get snow on them, and they do just fine because of that wool that traps the body heat. Mm-hmm. And keeps the sheep warm. So that's not really a good argument. If you look at what the church fathers have to say on this question, you get a mix of dates. You don't have a clear consensus like you do about the year. You don't have a clear consensus about the day. You get December 25th is one of the first days that we see being proposed. So is January 6th. And there are a few at other times of the year where some church fathers think it was a different day elsewhere in the year. But now, by the way, you also sometimes hear people trying to link this to a pagan holiday, and the arguments for that also are not good.
Yeah.
But the early, you don't have church fathers saying, hey, let's hijack a pagan holiday so people will have an alternative wholesome celebration. They don't say things like that. The ones who support December 25th say that's when I think he was born.
Yeah, right.
And so they're not, they don't betray an ulterior motive in what they're writing about this. So we don't know for sure. December 25th is a possibility, and it is one of the dates that's supported by the early church fathers. Now, there's another date that some have proposed based on the Bible. If you look in Revelation chapter 12, John sees a vision of a woman in heaven who is clothed with the sun, has the moon at her feet, and has a crown of 12 stars. Okay. The ancients were into astronomical signs. You know, you had, that's what brought the Magi to Israel, for example. Also, it says there right there in Genesis 1, God made the stars for signs. And so ancient people were looking for signs in the sky.
Right, right.
And it has been proposed by biblical scholars that John is encoding, because the woman then gives birth to Christ.
Yeah.
John is encoding information about when Jesus was born using astronomical signs. So, who's the woman in the sky, would you guess?
Mary.
Famous, not biblical. Think constellations.
Oh, the woman in the sky. Oh, in the constellations. Oh,
the famous Virgin constellation, maybe.
Yeah, oh, Virgo?
Virgo, that's right. And it so happens that periodically the sun will be in mid-body for Virgo, and the moon will be at the feet of Virgo.
Oh.
Now the sun goes mid-body every year, because the sun is passing through the zodiac. And so at some point in the year, it's going to hit mid-body on Virgo. But the question is then, is the moon at the same time going to be at her feet? And that doesn't happen so often. But it did happen on September 11th, 3 BC. And so some people have proposed September 11th, 3 BC, as Jesus' birthday.
How interesting and clever. And they were just so much more aware than we are. Like, for us, that might, we'd be like, well, that's kind of a magnificently obscure. It's not possible. But they really were much more aware of the sky than we are, of what was going on up there. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jimmy. Shall I give you another question? Well, let me ask you this before we have to go to a break. Why are Matthew and Luke's narratives so different? They don't read the same at all. I mean, I shouldn't say at all, but in general, they don't read the same. So
they incorporate certain basic facts. There are about a dozen facts that they both mention. You know, Jesus is born of a virgin. He was born in the reign of Herod the Great, things like that. His parents were Mary and Joseph and so forth. But then they record these very different stories. And I think the reason for that is because I think it's two reasons. One of them is writing to supplement the other. I think the authors of Matthew and Luke were aware of each other.
Yeah.
And so either Matthew wrote first and Luke is supplementing what Matthew said.
Oh.
Or, and I personally favor this, I think Luke wrote first and Matthew supplemented what Luke was doing. So I think that supplemental motive is one of the reasons they're different. The other, I think, is the audiences they're serving. My guess, and it's not more than a guess, but my guess is Matthew had Luke in front of him, and he says, oh, there's all this stuff about Mary, and he's got with his genealogy Jesus descending from David's son Nathan, not from Solomon. And how is my Jewish Christian audience that I'm writing for going to react to that? I don't know that they're that interested in all this Mary stuff and in the way he descends from Nathan. I think they are going to want to hear more about Joseph, you know, who's the legal descendant of David for purposes of his messiahship, and how Joseph descends from Solomon, who was the king. And so I think Matthew came along, he saw what Luke said, and yeah, this is all right, but I don't think it serves the interests of my audience as well as this other material.
Yeah.
And so I think he deliberately went with other material because he doesn't have space in a gospel. They needed to fit in a single scroll.
Yeah.
Because they were so expensive. They needed to just be one volume works. And so he has to say, well, I have this other material that I really want to tell my audience about, so I'm just not going to include this stuff.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, you wouldn't, you don't, he doesn't need to do both genealogies. Luke has that one. Let me tell you the one that goes for Joseph's family from that includes Solomon. And as you have said, over 1,000 years, there's probably 10 million different ways you could arrange Jesus descending from David. I mean, I don't know how many.
Absolutely. There are multiple lines of descent.
Yeah, right.
Because of the ways these works. Like Queen Elizabeth is descended from William the Conqueror like 100 different ways or something. And Jesus descended from David multiple different ways. But there's actually, and we may want to touch on this after the break, there's actually an interesting reason why Matthew and Luke may have highlighted these two different lines of descent.
Okay, we'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The only thing new about the heresies in the church and the schisms in the church today is it's mixed with satanic worship. We in the church have gone from enneagrams to centering prayer to solstice worship to goddesses. And you buy it as something new.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Okay, so Jimmy, we're in the midst of talking in a general conversation about the nativity of Jesus. We're in the midst of talking about the two different lineages given for Jesus in Matthew and Luke. You wanted to make one more point about that.
Yeah. Also, I should mention there's a common idea you hear that Matthew's is Joseph's lineage and Luke's is Mary's. And it's actually hard to support that, given the evidence, because that is not what Luke says. Luke does not mention Mary in his genealogy at all. So it's hard to suppose that this is Mary's genealogy. But there's an interesting reason why they may have focused on these two different lines of descent. In the Old Testament, there is a curse placed on Jeconiah, king of Israel, at the time of the Babylonian exile. It says none of his sons are going to sit on the throne. And there's also another prophecy about the future restoration of the Davidic monarchy, where it says a shoot will grow from the stump of Jesse. This is a famous messianic prophecy.
Right.
And so some Jews apparently put that together and said, okay, so none of Jeconiah's descendants, because they could all be called his sons, none of Jeconiah's descendants are ever going to be on the throne of Israel. Instead, a different branch from Jesse, who was the father of David, a different branch of the Davidic family is going to become king. And there will be a new dynasty. Now, Jeconiah was descended from Solomon. And so, according to some interpretations, it could not be from the Solomon line that ran through Jeconiah that the Messiah would come. Uh-huh. Instead, he'd come from a different lineage from the Davidic family. But that wasn't certain, because there are other ways of taking the Jeconiah prophecy. Maybe it just meant none of his immediate sons are going to be on the throne because of the Babylonian exile. But that doesn't say anything about his long-term descendants.
I see.
And so you could have these two schools of thought, and it's possible that that's why Matthew and Luke use these two different lines. It's a way of saying, look, whichever theory you like about the Jeconiah curse, Jesus is still qualifies. If you think the Messiah needs to be a descendant of Solomon, he is.
Oh,
and if you think he needs to be a descendant from a different son of David than Solomon, he is.
Oh, okay.
Because he's got more than one line of descent.
I want to ask you about the star of David. The star that that leads the Magi. Yeah, the Star of Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And what is it, and who were the Magi? And this is in Matthew's gospel, not mentioned in Luke's gospel.
Right. So it's hard to know for sure what the star was. You've got a bunch of different proposals. I mean, the Aetherius Society thinks it was an alien spaceship, but they're wrong.
On so many things, the Aetherius Society. So many things.
Yeah. Actually, a lot of things.
Yeah.
You'll also have the idea that it was a comet, mm-hmm. but it probably was not a comet. Comets were seen in the ancient world as omens of disaster, not the births of kings. You've had the proposal it could be a meteor, but meteors last for like a fraction of a second. They don't hang in the sky the way this thing did for the Magi. It's been proposed it was a supernatural phenomenon. And that's often based on the idea that they were following it, that it was leading them around, and then it came to hover over the house saying, this is the house.
Yeah.
That's not actually what the text says. In this area, I'm just giving my opinion. Other people can have different opinions, but based on, and that's fine. Based on my read of the evidence, though, I don't think that's likely, because all the text really says is that the star was in front of them on the way to Bethlehem. And when they found the house, the star was above it. So it doesn't say the star was moving around in an unusual way. Also, if there was an unexpected new star, they wouldn't know how to interpret it, because it wouldn't fit in to their system of astrology.
Right.
And it wouldn't have any meaning. It's this new star. What are we supposed to make of that? So I think it was an established star. And because the fixed stars that just orbit every day don't move around, they don't have a lot of significance by themselves. The way ancient astrology worked was you looked at the planets, the wandering stars that move around in the sky, and you say, what part of the sky is this planet in? And that has a meaning. And there was one particular planet that was associated with kingship. Now, we kind of need to know about where the Magi were from in order to have a good guess at what kind of system of astrology they were using. A lot of times it's assumed that they were using Greek astrology, because that's what most Western astrology is based on, was Greek astrology. But they came from the East.
Yeah.
So why would they be using Greek astrology? There are different theories about who they could have been. I know Father Longnecker has a book suggesting they may have been Nabataeans. I look forward to reading his argument. I haven't had a chance to yet. In the Church Fathers, you have a lot of people saying they were from Persia or Arabia or Babylon. Babylon is a very promising candidate. And we know a good bit about Babylonian astrology because we've got the records. You know, they had astrological books that we've found. And in Babylonian astrology, like in other astrologies of the period, Jupiter was the planet associated with kings.
Mm-hmm.
And Jupiter, by coincidence, in December of 2 BC, was hanging in the sky in the south as you were walking from Jerusalem to Bethlehem.
Oh.
So, and Jupiter is associated with a bunch of other stuff. It's actually fascinating. In Babylonian astrology, they had a whole bunch of signs involving Jupiter and Venus and Regulus, which was a star that they also regarded as connected with kingship. And one of my favorite examples is they had, if there is a lunar eclipse and Jupiter is not in the sky for the lunar eclipse, if the kingship star is not in the sky when the lunar eclipse occurs, that means the current king in Babylon is going to die. And so what they did to protect the current king is they appointed a substitute king. They took a They had a substitute king ritual where they took a condemned criminal who was going to die anyway. They made him king for like 3 months. They had the real king demoted to like, oh, he's a farmer now. And we're having the priest talk about him like he's just a farmer now. And this is the real king over here, the condemned criminal guy. And then they would wait out the danger period and then execute the condemned criminal, and the real king would assume his throne again.
I swear there's a movie in there. There's got to be a movie in there.
It's kind of like the Mikado.
Yeah.
According to Babylonian astrology, there were certain signs involving Jupiter that would indicate the current king of in Babylon is going to be overthrown. And there was another sign that said a important king is going to be born in a land called Amuru. Amuru is west from Babylon, but it's on this side of the Mediterranean. So that points us at, it's not as far west as Greece or Rome. It's on the eastern side of the Mediterranean, so that points to Israel. And these signs involving Jupiter happened in 3 and 2 BC.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a very interesting book out on this subject that that suggests, okay, they saw the signs saying the king of Babylon's going to be overthrown. There's going to be this great king born in the west. Let's head west and go to the only semi-independent king in the area, the major one, Herod the Great, and make peace early to get this new king on our side so that when he knocks over the king of Babylon, we will benefit from that.
Yeah.
And that, according to this theory, is what they saw and how it motivated them. And one of the signs is also the one from the Book of Revelation. So there's a lot of stuff converging here, even though we can't be sure of everything. There's a lot of stuff converging here on this 3-2 BC time frame that makes sense in terms of Babylonian astrology.
Jimmy, before we have to end today, I just want to ask you, because you hinted at it earlier, is there any information outside the Bible, in addition to this kind of astrological information, that we should be aware of as far as the nativity of Jesus?
One of the things that several of these early documents, like the Ascension of Isaiah and the Proto-Evangelium of James mention, is that Mary had a miraculous birth. That it was not just a normal birth, that something miraculous happened. This is mentioned in the Ascension of Isaiah, which, like I said, seems to date to the year AD 67. Also, it's mentioned in the Proto-Evangelium of James in the mid-second century. The Proto-Evangelium of James also says Jesus was born in a cave, and that's the Grotto of the Nativity in Bethlehem today. And other ancient sources also indicate that he was born in a cave, because houses were often constructed based on caves, and people would keep their animals inside. And that's why Mary is laying Jesus in a manger, according to these early sources, in a cave, because at the time it was a home. There was a section of the home that was reserved for the animals, and the main dining area, the cataluma, was full of people. And so that's why they were in this other part of the house. Incidentally, when Jesus is later in Luke, when Jesus is sending the disciples to go find the upper room so they can have Passover, he says, ask for where the cataluma is, where I'm going to receive it. So this was not a traveler's inn necessarily. It could just be a part of a house where people lived and met and ate, and that's what was full.
Jimmy Akin, thanks very, very much. I appreciate it. Oh, you know what? You have written about the accounts of Jesus' childhood at jimmyakin.com, right? People, if people want to read more, they can go there.
It's called How the Accounts of Jesus's Childhood Fit Together.
At jimmyakin.com, A-K-I-N. Jimmy, thanks very much. Have a great weekend.
You too, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, yes. It's upon us now, just a week away. I probably should start my Christmas shopping. I probably should get started on that. Ah, we'll see. Maybe this weekend. Well, that does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.